You are now listening to Justice Lit on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Musqueam people at the University of British Columbia. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Justice Lit. We are back with another episode of the Shakespeare series. We are going to finally surpass Sonnet 100 this episode. And so I'm very excited for that, and I'm super stoked to have gone this far. And I'm glad that everyone has been enjoying it so far. I have been as well, and so that is, I'm very happy about that. Just a bit of housekeeping before we start. Today is going to be the last episode of the month, obviously. And for the first 3 weeks, or I think almost 3.5 weeks of June, I will be out of the country. I'm visiting my friends and family in South Korea. For the first 3.5 weeks of June, I'll be coming back on the 26th of June. And so the times I will be in Korea, I will not be doing my live show. And so the Shakespeare series will be on hold for a little bit until I come back from my trip. And so just to let you guys know, just to let you guys know that will be happening. I'm super excited. I haven't seen my friends and family there in a while, and so that's that. Other than that, nothing much. Today we will be starting Sonnet 97, but before that, of course, I have one song to play for you guys. It'll be Eagle and Hawk by Sundancer, followed by some ads, show promos, and PSAs, and so we'll be right back after this.
Dancer in this world, do you walk the Sundancer line?
Hello. Take a moment to ease your mind. I'm glad you're here. Have you been to that sacred place within? That place that sound can create? Let's go there together. A place with the freshest beats. Gamelan tones of Indonesia. The many sounds of Brazil. The possibilities are infinite. All available on Mixitroph, the best in world music, every other Thursday from 6 to 7 p.m. Join me, Nolzy, for exclusive interviews with local musicians and musical explorations. Tune in! Is the simple joy of riding a bike missing from your life? No worries. Ride On Bike Shop has got you covered. Ride On has the best deals in town for new and used bikes, top-notch servicing, and all the parts or accessories you've been dreaming about. Whether you've got a little one who needs to learn how to ride, or if you're about to go on the Tour de France, Ride On is the place for you. We'll also happily pick up your old bikes and recycle them back into the community. Located on 2255 West Broadway, we are open from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. from Tuesday to Saturday. That's R-I-D-E-O-N Bike Shop. See you there!
I love being the one who fosters inclusion and community spirit, and in return, I get to expand my own network and friendships. And it's all for the benefit of the kids.
Take our online quiz and find your perfect volunteer role. Adventure awaits. Join us at scouts.ca/volunteer.
Are you interested in radio? Do you want to start your own show, but you don't know where to get started? Make your radio dreams come true by joining a collective. From the news collective, the arts collective, the music collective, the sports collective, the accessibility collective, the indigenous collective, and the intersectionality collective, there's something for everyone, and we provide free technical training to get started. Explore these worlds virtually and in person, and be prepared to make fun friends. For more information, visit citr.ca/get involved.
Picture this. You're walking into your local record store and start skimming the many records until you find an album that you recognize. You pick out the album, check the track list, and maybe only recognize a couple songs. Now you have to listen to the whole album, right? Well, why not do it together? On Discali, every show runs you through an entire album and breaks down key parts and songs that make up an album's aesthetic, art, and story. I'm your host, Oliver, and join me every Friday from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. in talking about all things music. Want to discover more albums, artists, record pressings, and concerts? I got you. That's every Friday from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m., so tune in to Discali to discover different discographies and add to the musical discourse.
We are back with Just As Lit. You just finished listening to Eagle and Hawk by Sundancer and some ads, show promos, and PSAs. We'll get right into Sonnet 97. How like a winter hath my absence been from thee, the pleasure of the fleeting year. What freezings have I felt, what dark days seen, what old December's bareness everywhere. And yet this time removed was summer's time, the teeming autumn, big with rich increase, bearing the wanton burden of the prime, like widowed wombs after their lord's decease. Yet this abundant issue seemed to me but hope of orphans and unfathered fruit. For summer and his pleasures wait on thee, and thou away the very birds are mute. Or if they sing, 'tis with so dull a cheer, they that leaves look pale, dreading the winters near. Now, we are seeing that, well, this sonnet kind of describes the period of separation from the beloved. And the poet remembers the time as bleak winter, though the actual season was warm and filled with nature's abundance. And so with lines 1 to 4, we are opened with a simile that absence is like a winter. And so not just a cold season, winter here becomes a metaphor for emotional desolation. The beloved is equated with warmth and pleasure, seen in the phrase, the pleasure of the fleeting year. And this implies that time without them lacks vitality. And the language of freezings, dark days, and bareness, they all signal a sensory deprivation, aligning with the emotional emptiness with physical cold. With lines 5 and 8, we are provided with the volta here, and the phrase, and yet, is kind of the signifier of the volta, which disrupts the initial metaphor. The speaker here admits that the actual season was summer, and even autumn, times of fertility and rich increase and teeming abundance, they all play into the seasonal summer. And however, though, yet to the speaker, these seasons were experienced as barren. And so the metaphor grows more bodily and reproductive, as in the phrase bearing the wanton burden of the prime, and how that this invokes invokes pregnancy, while widowed wombs evokes loss and abandonment. And so we could see also see here that Shakespeare layers the metaphor, where just as a widow may be pregnant after her husband's death, the world may be full, but its fullness is haunted by loss. With lines 9 to 12, the phrase abundant issue feels illegitimate and orphaned and quote-unquote unfathered. And this metaphor, in a sense, feminizes the earth and masculinizes the beloved, casting him as a generative force or source whose absence renders all creation suspect or incomplete. The phrase unfathered fruit continues the theme of disrupted fecundity, and where without the beloved, the generative cycle is broken. And so even birdsong fails in its absence, and nature becomes listless, quiet, and melancholic. The final couplet kind of clinches on conceit. And so if there is music at all, it is joyless. And so we get a bit of a paradox throughout the whole poem here. The very leaves, which in a sense symbolize the seasonal vibrancy, looks pale, as if drained from life, and the specter of winter, both literal and emotional, ultimately looms. And even amid summer, the world reacts as though death were imminent, and this kind of reaffirms the poem's emotional logic, where absence rewrites time and nature, and thus overwrites seasonal order with psychological disorder. And so that was Sonnet 97. Moving on to Sonnet 98. From you have I been absent in the spring, when proud-pied April, dressed in all his trim, hath put a spirit of youth in everything that heavy Saturn lighted, laughed and leapt with him. Yet nor the lays of birds, nor the sweet smell of different flowers in odor and in hue, could make me any summer's story tell, or from their proud lap pluck them where they grew. Nor did I wonder at the lily's white, nor praise the deep vermilion in the rose. They were but sweet, but figures of delight, drawn after you, you pattern of all those, yet seemed in winter still, and you away, as with your shadow I with these did play. Here the poet remembers an April separation, in which springtime beauty seemed to him only a pale reflection of the absent beloved. And so with lines 1 to 4, the poem opens with a confession of absence, not merely spatial, but also seasonal and affective. Spring, which kind of signifies the renewal and sensuality of flourishing, is seen as the backdrop, and yet the speaker remains emotionally distant. And we could see that April is quote-unquote proud pied, suggesting a variegated, dazzling richness, and is, quote, dressed in all his trim, which signifies abundance. Now, the reference to Saturn typically is a melancholic and aged figure who paradoxically laughed and leapt. Now, this kind of portrayal suggests that even the most unlikely entities are animated by spring's vitality. However, the speaker remains inert and immune, and this juxtaposition underscores the unnaturalness of his detachment, where even time itself is briefly rejuvenated, but he is not. With lines 5 and 8, we get a kind of a catalog of sensory pleasures. For example, song with lays of birds, scent and color also, but these fail ultimately to stir the speaker. Nature's offerings are abundant, yet he cannot craft a quote-unquote summer story, which is a metaphor for poetic or erotic vitality, and his inability to pluck the flowers from their proud lap resonates with both literal and metaphoric sexual imagery. And so the flowers remain untouched and unclaimed because they are mere stand-ins, simulacra of the absent beloved. We could see a profound erotic displacement here in this quatrain, where beauty exists, but it is inert, unmoored from desire. And so we can see that the body is present in the world, but the affective circuit that makes beauty vivid is broken. With lines 9 to 12, the speaker now explicitly states the ontological hierarchy at play through the lily and the rose. And this, in a sense, symbolizes the canonical emblems of purity and passion, and how the lily and the rose ultimately fail to arouse awe. They are, quote-unquote, but figures of delight, which are only representations, sketches that are drawn after, in this case, you. The beloved is seen as the ideal form and the platonic archetype from which all natural beauty derives. And we get a lot of theories and notions of aesthetics and the erotics, which is interesting here. And the lines perform, or the line of the drawn after you, you pattern of all those, performs a reversal of mimesis, where nature imitates the beloved, not the other way around. And so, the final couplet performs an inversion. Despite it being spring, it seemed winter still. Now, time and season are affectively redefined by the beloved's absence, and the speaker's interactions with spring's pleasures are likened to playing with a shadow, which is seen as a metaphor for illusion, insustainability, insubstantiality, and the trace of presence. Moving on to Sonnet 99. The forward violet, thus did I chide. Sweet thief, whence didst thou steal thy sweet that smells? If not from my love's breath, the purple pride, which on thy soft cheek for complexion dwells, in my love's veins thou... In my love veins thou hast too grossly dyed the lily I condemned for thy hand, and buds of majoram has stolen thy hair, the roses fearfully on thorns did stand, blushing shame another white despair, a third nor red nor white had stolen of both, and to this robbery had annexed thy breath, but for this, for his theft and pride of all his growth, a vengeful canker ate him up to death. More flowers I noted, yet I none could see, but sweet or color it had stolen from thee. Now, Sonnet 99 is about the beloved's absence, again, and how this sonnet is closely linked to 98, the previous one we just read. And so the present sonnet, the poet accuses spring flowers and herbs of stealing color and fragrance from the beloved. And so the sonnet is unusual in that the first quatrain has 5 lines, and the poem therefore has 15 lines. And so this is the only such sonnet in this sequence. And so this is a very interesting and unique poem. And so we'll... get this from this, with lines 1 to 5, the speaker begins by accusing a violet of theft, and so the flower is forward, perhaps meaning premature blooming, but also impertinent or presumptuous. The violet has stolen its fragrance and color from the beloved, and that seen thy sweet that smells comes from my love's breath and its purple pride, and this is metaphorically dyed in the lover's veins. And so again, we are dealing with the erotics here, where the lover's bodily presence, especially their breath and blood, becomes a source of nature's beauty. With lines 6 and 10, the other flowers are tried and condemned in this court of aesthetic theft, where the lily stands for the beloved's hand, while majoram buds have stolen their hair. And the roses tremble fearfully on their thorns, again anthropomorphized as guilty thieves. With lines 11 to 14, here, the third rose, which is the hybrid, has gone too far, even annexing the beloved's breath. But nature punished, punishes this audacity. In conclusion, and a vengeful canker will destroy the rose, enacting a kind of cosmic justice. Beauty that is stolen and claimed with pride is doomed to rot. And the final line of 15 kind of functions up as a... or functions as a summing up, and elevates the beloved to the source of all natural beauty, and every sweet smell or color in nature is merely a theft, a reflection, and is never original, and the beloved is the origin, ultimately, and beyond imitation. Moving on to Sonnet 100, we have Hit 100. Where art thou, muse, that thou forgest so long to speak of that which gives thee all thy might? Spendest thou thy fury on some worthless song, darkening thy power to lend base subjects light? Return, forgetful muse, and straight redeem in gentle numbers time so idly spent. Sing to the ear that doth thy lays esteem and gives thy pen both skill and argument. Rise, resty muse, my love's sweet face survey, if time have any wrinkle graven there, if any be a satire to decay, and make time's spoils despised everywhere, give my love fame faster than time wastes life, so thou preventest his scythe and crooked knife. Now here is about a period of time in which the poet has failed to write about the beloved, and the poet summons his poetic genius to return and compose verse that will ultimately immortalize the beloved. And so with lines 1 to 4, we kind of get a casting of bewilderment and frustration, where the poet directly addresses the muse, which is the classical symbol of inspiration and poetic power, and accuses her of forgetfulness. And so ultimately here, the poet posits a symbolic or symbiotic relationship between the muse and the subject of praise, where without the beloved, the muse has no strength. And moving on down to the last two lines of lines 3 and 4, we kind of see a paradox in specifically the phrase "darkening thy power." And so in trying to illuminate something base, the muse actually diminishes her own brilliance. And so this line also reflects a metapoetic anxiety, a concern about poetry's proper object, its moral and aesthetic obligations. With lines 5 to 8, the command return makes a turning point where the imperative toward poetic restoration is signified. The phrase redeem suggests not only return, but also atonement. The phrase ear here is likely that of the beloved, or perhaps a discerning reader who appreciates the muse's lays, and this figure enables the muse's credibility, where he both values her art and provides her skill and argument. With lines 9 to 12, the phrase resty continues the earlier critique of the muse's idleness, and the speaker now urges her to look and to perform the act of observation and recording core poetic duties. Should any decay be found, the muse is charged with turning into satire, mockery, or exposure. And so this is an intriguing twist where, rather than lamenting on resisting time, the poet enlists the muse to shame time itself. The final couplet is offering a solution to the threat of time, where it is the immortalization through verse. And so if the muse gives the beloved fame at a pace that outstrips time's destructive force, then she will ultimately prevent the deadly effects of his quote-unquote hith scythe and crooked knife. And so the poem's ultimate faith lies in poetry's power to transcend mortality. And so that was Sonnet 100. Before we move on to Sonnet 101, we have one more song called "Love Me Tonight" by Vern Chichu. We'll be right back after this. She walked into the bar, old lover said, with the long brown hair and blue jeans skin tight. I just couldn't believe my eyes as she moved from side to side. Oh, she looks so fine, I think I'm gonna lose my mind. Oh, baby, baby, love me tonight, and everything will be alright. I'll leave a drink of wine, anything you want, just let me love you tonight. Just want and need to get a job on inside. I just couldn't believe my eyes when she moved from side to side. Oh, she looks so fine, I think I'm gonna lose my mind. Oh, baby, baby, love me tonight, and everything will be alright. I'll drink the wine, and anything you want. That was Love Me Tonight by Vern Chichu. Sonnet 101. O Trant Muse, what shall be thy amends for thy neglect of truth and beauty died? Both truth and beauty on my love depends, so dost thou too, and therein dignified. Make answer, Muse, wilt thou not haply say, truth needs no color with this color fixed, beauty no pencil beauty's truth to lay, but best is best if ever intermixed. Because he needs no praise, wilt thou be dumb? Excuse not silence, so forlies in thee, to make him much outlive a gilded tomb, and to be praised of ages yet to be, then do thy office, Muse, I teach thee how, to make him seem long hence as he shows now. Now, continuing from Sonnet 100, this poem has the muse tell the poet that the beloved needs no praise. The poet responds that the poems are for the edification of future ages. With lines 1 to 4, the speaker opens with an apostrophe to the muse, accusing her of trancy, abandoning her poetic duties. The phrase died suggests artificial enhancement, raising a tension between natural beauty and poetic embellishment. The speaker also claims that his beloved embodies both truth and beauty. The muse herself is dignified by her association with the beloved, thus neglecting to praise him, diminishes her over her own stature. Lines 5 to 8. The speaker anticipates the muse's rebuttal that truth does not require poetic coloring because it already has a fixed inherent hue. And similarly, beauty does not need the poet's pencil to reveal its truth. The final line of the quatrain, but best is best if never intermixed, is in a sense ambiguous. It can suggest that truth and beauty are best when kept pure and separate. Or it could mean truth and beauty are at their best when not mixed with artificiality. With lines 9 to 12, the speaker is seen to reject the muse's silence as a form of false modesty, and because he needs no praise, that phrase is not a valid reason for neglecting poetic duty. We get a contrast of the fleeting physical memorials with the immortalizing power of verse as well. And the final couplet kind of directly commands that the muse must do her job. The speaker asserts his own poetic authority in the phrase, I teach thee who, how, which is a reversal of roles. And poetry through accurate and inspired representation can ultimately preserve the beloved's image across time. And so that was Sonnet 101. Sonnet 102. My love is strengthened, though more weak in seeming. I love not less, though less the show appear. That love is merchandised, whose rich esteeming the owner's tongue doth publish everywhere. Our love was new, and then but in the spring, when I was wont to greet it with my lays, as Philomel in summer's front doth sing, and stops his pipe in growth of riper days. Not that the summer is less pleasant now than when her mournful hymns did hush the night, but that wild music burdens every bough, and sweets grown common lose their dead delight. Therefore, like her, I sometime hold my tongue, because I would not dull you with my song. Now here the poet defends his silence, arguing that it is a sign not of lessened love, but of his desire, in a world where pleasures have grown common, to avoid wearying the beloved with poems of praise. With lines 1 to 4, the opening lines establish a paradox where the speaker's love is more powerful even though it appears weaker. And so this introduces the tension between inner feeling and outward display. So Shakespeare's use here of the antithesis, strengthened versus weak, or the not less versus the less the show, kind of signals that the poem will probe the different the probe the difference between essence and appearance, and also truth and performance. And so when we move on to lines 3 and 4, the speaker critiques love that is constantly spoken of and displayed. And the metaphor of love being merchandised suggests that public declarations commodify affection, which, in conclusion, cheapens it. And to publish everywhere is to turn private passion into public currency as well. With lines 5 to 8, the speaker recalls the early days of the relationship, likening them to spring, which is a time of blossoming and poetic celebration. And the comparison to Philomel, which is a poetic name for the nightingale, which is rooted in the myth of Philomela, extends the metaphor of the seasons. And so the bird sings at the start of summer but fails or falls silent as the season matures. With lines 9 to 10, 9 to 12, the speaker anticipates a possible misreading where silence does not imply diminished affection. Summer is still beautiful, perhaps more so, and the mournful hymns refer back to the nightingale's song, which, though beautiful, is described as mournful, and this suggests a kind of youthful melancholy or longing typical of the early stages of love. Now, in lines 11 to 12, the speaker suggests that constant repetition diminishes impact, and wild music burdens every bow, conjures an image of overabundance, where beauty becomes overwhelming and even exhausting. The final couplet returns to the nightingale's metaphor to justify the speaker's reticence. Silence becomes a form of respect and preservation, and the speaker refrains from speaking of love not out of disinterest, but to protect its intensity from erosion through overuse. Sonnet 103. Alack, what poverty my muse brings forth, that having such a scope to show her pride, the argument all bear is of more worth than when it hath my eye added praise be it beside. Oh, blame me not if I more can write, look in your glass and there appears a face that overgoes my blunt invention quiet, dulling my lines and doing me disgrace. Were it not sinful then striving to mend, to mar the subject that before was well, for to no other pass my verses tend, than of your graces and your gifts to tell, and more, much more than in my verse can sit, your own glass shows you when you look in it. In this fourth poem of apology for his silence, the poet argues that the beloved's own face is so superior to any world of praise that silence is the better way. Now here, when we look into lines 1 to 4, the speaker opens with an exclamation of alack, a lament that signals sorrow or frustration. And his muse, which is the inspiration for his poetry, is impoverished, unable to produce verse adequate to the task of praising the beloved. The phrase, such a scope to show her pride, suggests the beloved offers vast poetic potential, yet the poet feels unable to fulfill it. Indeed, the argument all bear phrase is worth more than anything the poet might add, and this confession displaces the authority of the poet onto the beauty of the beloved, suggesting that language only diminishes the truth it tries to represent. With lines 5 and 8, these lines shift the poem into a direct address, where the speaker begs the beloved not to blame him for his poetic silence or failure. And the phrase blunt invention speaks to the inadequacy of poetic artifice. It is not sharp or precise enough to capture beauty. And ironically, the act of writing dulls the speaker's poetry. Or in a sense, dulls the speaker's lines, where poetry cannot sharpen or elevate the subject, but instead causes disgrace to both the poet and the object. With lines 9 to 12, we are presented with a rhetorical question, and this intensifies the speaker's crisis, where it is not sinful to try to mend what was already perfect. That was the question. Is it not sinful to try to mend what was already perfect? That's the question. And the attempt to improve the beloved's beauty through verse actually mars or corrupt it. The verb mar points to an ethical or almost religious reverence for the beloved's form. And so the poem's only aim, the speaker insists, is to tell of the beloved's graces and gifts. And so there's an implicit paradox here where the poetic devotion leads to poetic failure. The final couplet confirms the triumph of mirror over meter. The mirror, a symbol of unmediated reflection, displaces the poem as the true vessel of beauty. And the poem becomes a sense of anti-poem, where it's a withdrawal from the poetic in favor of the visual, the direct, and the embodied. Moving on to Sonnet 104. To me, fair friend, you never can be old, for as you were when first your eye eyed, such seems your beauty still. Three winters cold have from the forests shook three summers' pride. Three beauteous springs to yellow autumn turned in process of the seasons have I seen. Three April perfumes in three hot Junes burned since first I saw you fresh, which yet are green. Ah, yet doth beauty like a dial hand steal from his figure and no pace perceived. So your sweet hue, which methinks still doth stand, hath motion in mine eye may be deceived. For fear of which, hear this, thou age unbred, ere you were born was beauty's summer dead. So here the poet ponders the beloved's seemingly unchanging beauty, realizing that it is doubtless altering even as he watches. And he warns that the epitome of beauty will have died before future ages are born. So with lines 1 to 4, the speaker opens with a paradox, where although time has passed, the beloved appears untouched by it. And the repetition of I in your I eyed emphasizes the act of looking, where the poetic vision that freezes the beloved is in a timeless state. The mention of the three winters cold, shaking three summers pride, invokes natural cycles to mark the cycles or passages of time, and this suggests that while nature ages, the beloved's beauty resists decay. Lines 5 and 8, these lines continue the seasonal motif. Spring, associated with youth and beauty, turns to autumn, which symbolizes aging. And the April perfumes suggests fleeting sensuality or vitality, which are burned away by the heart of June, possibly a metaphor for passion or time's consuming force. However, the frame remains fresh and green, resisting the transformations imposed by time. And the green invokes youth, but also an enduring vitality, like an evergreen that does not shed its leaves. With lines 9 to 12, the speaker acknowledges the paradox of imperceptible change. The metaphor of the dial hand suggests that beauty fades slowly and subtly, so slowly that the motion is not perceptible. The dial hand is also implied as the clock's hand. And so this admission marks a shift from the earlier assertion of timelessness to a recognition of time's stealthy erosion. This admission is seen as the beloved's appearing to be unchanged, but that unchanging aspect might be an illusion, and this could be seen in the phrase, mine eye may be deceived. The final couplet is a concluding one, and it delivers a powerful twist where anticipating a future audience, So by anticipating a future audience, the speaker declares that beauty has already peaked and is in decline. And the summer of beauty, in the height of its splendor, has already passed, even if it appears otherwise. And this ironic ending casts a melancholic shadow over the preceding lines, revealing the speaker's awareness of time and time's inevitable effects, despite appearances. And so that was Sonnet 104, and we will stop for today. We went through a lot of sonnets today, and so that will be the end of the sonnets for today. Just one, I guess, announcement to make. It's a really accomplishing announcement for myself. One of my papers got published in the High Window Press. It is a literary magazine press located in the UK, and my paper on Shakespeare, specifically my argument there, my thesis was Desire as a Virus. I mentioned it before because I presented this in the Undergraduate Shakespeare Society conference at UBC, but the paper on Desire as a Virus in Hamlet and Macbeth, that paper was published in the High Window Press just a couple days ago, and so if you guys are interested, please go check that out. It's just in the highwindowpress.com, I believe, and if you press on essay, my paper will be published on that press. And so, yeah, that was just one exciting thing that happened to me recently. But, yeah, that is the end of today's show. Again, today will be just, I guess, the last for a while, because I will be going on leave. I'm going to go visit some family and friends in South Korea for the first 3.5 weeks of June. And so during then, I will not be having any live episodes. I will be having, I guess, playback episodes, but they won't be live. And so we will be continuing the Shakespeare series with 105, Sonnet 105, on So then I won't be doing any shows for the month of June. So our next show now would be on July 2nd. And so I hope you guys have a good rest of your week and the whole rest of June, because I won't be on. And I will see you guys again in the second day of July. That is when we'll be continuing our Shakespeare series. And so, yeah, thank you all for joining Just as Lit, and I will see you guys in a month. Bye-bye.